Progressive voice of Minnesota here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. It is the Thursday edition of the show. Patrick Lilia, feels like you haven't produced one of my shows in a while, but how are you doing? Good to have you back behind the production glass.
Yeah, I've been here. I've just been kind of hanging out behind the scenes on assignment, so it's good to on assignment is the...
I was going to say, now we know you're a radio pro by using that term, on assignment.
I know, right?
I love that, yeah. Whenever so-and-so, this anchor is away, on assignment. You can literally be doing anything when you're on assignment. Big show coming up, as in the second half, we are going to be joined by Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality. I've been meaning to get them on the show for a while and got a hold of Michelle Gross, as she's going to be telling us about a series of meetings that are taking place in Minneapolis this fall. It's called the People's Floyd Commission, as they are going to be picking up where the city, well, never really took off in the first place in terms of holding public meetings in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. At least the city of Minneapolis seemed like they were going to be promising, we're going to be holding listening sessions and community conversations in regards to George Floyd. Well, those never happened, so Communities United Against Police Brutality have taken over in that sense, and they are holding a series of five meetings called the People's Floyd Commission all throughout Minneapolis, including one that is taking place tomorrow. We'll tell you about that in the second half of the show with Michelle Gross. But let's get to some news for today. Mike Pence and Ivanka Trump are in Minneapolis. Not exactly the friendliest territory for them, but they won't be meeting with the general public. They will instead be meeting with the group Cops for Trump. Remember those T-shirts that several Minneapolis police officers wore when Trump held a rally in Minnesota? I think it was last year. And people were trying to identify if Derek Chauvin was one of the guys who was wearing those Cops for Trump shirts. It turns out that he was not one of the guys that was prominently featured in that photo. But one person who is a member of Cops for Trump is, of course, Bob Kroll. And I have to wonder if Bob Kroll is going to be rearing his ugly head at this meeting with with Mike Pence and Ivanka Trump. Sure he will be, because usually when you find a member of the Trump administration, Bob Kroll is not going to be far behind. And the timing of this, of course, very curious, being that it is the day after we had, well, the lack of any indictments with the police officers that shot Breonna Taylor. And by the way, I got to bring this up. Why do we still use grand juries when we have police shootings? It's just unbelievable that we continue to do this. Now, a little background on a grand jury. It's basically something that a prosecutor can use if they want to take a little extra precaution before they prosecute anyone. But generally, with a grand jury, 99.9% of the time, you can get an indictment. You have to royally screw up your case as a prosecutor to not get an indictment. And the reason why in a grand jury case is that there's no defense. It's only the prosecutor talking to the jury. So they don't even get to hear from the defense. That's why the old joke is in the lawyer community is that, well, you can pretty much with a grand jury indict anything. You can indict a paperclip of all things. But the only times it seems a grand jury does not indict anyone is when we have a police shooting. And of course, we saw that yesterday in Kentucky, in Louisville, with the Breonna Taylor case. Now, of course, they did indict the police officer on, well, threatening the walls of the neighbors, but no indictment with the fact that Breonna Taylor was shot. Just unbelievable that we still continue to use a grand jury system. They even abolished the grand jury system in Europe. And it's... What bugs me about this, too, is that the Kentucky Attorney General who took over this case, like I said, he could have gotten an indictment on anything he wanted because it's very easy to indict someone in a grand jury. But likely what was happening he was probably playing the side of the defense in this case and defending the police officers, which is not your job as the prosecutor. That's the job for the defense attorney, not your job as the attorney general. So that's the latest of what's happening in Louisville, Kentucky. You can get a lot more on that on our national shows. We're more locally based, but wanted to bring that up since we do have Mike Pence and Ivanka Trump visiting Minnesota. What else do we have in the news today locally? The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has endorsed Jason Lewis for Senate. Now, here's why I bring this up. I normally wouldn't pay attention to the fact that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is endorsing anyone, but this gets to another pet peeve I have with politics. So the lobby, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, has endorsed Jason Lewis while also endorsing Angie Craig and Dean Phillips. Now, here's why I bring this up. Do you know anyone? Patrick, chime in on this, too. I can't think of a single person who is going to be someone that's going to vote for both Dean Phillips for Congress and Jason Lewis for Senate. Who is that voter that is going to vote for Jason Lewis and Dean Phillips?
I guess whoever the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Minnesota is.
Well, the point is, though, they're not even doing this because they legitimately endorse these candidates. What they want to do is appear bipartisan when they make their endorsements. So they can go off and say, well, we endorse both Republican and Democratic candidates. Newspapers are notorious for doing this, too. I mean, the Star Tribune did this for years where Eric Paulson was always their fallback guy that they would endorse because often they would endorse Democratic candidates for office. But to try to appear bipartisan, they would always pick one or two Republicans that they would officially endorse. And Eric Paulson was always their fallback guy, where in every congressional race they would endorse the Democratic candidate, but then they would sit there and think, well, I suppose we better endorse a Republican too. Oh, let's go to Eric Paulson. So I'll be interested this fall now that the Star Tribune no longer has Eric Paulson to endorse. But that's always been a pet peeve of mine with politics when it comes to endorsements and why, for the most part, they're pretty much worthless when it comes to media organizations or lobbying groups when they give endorsements. They don't mean anything if you're just going to be bipartisan for the sake of being bipartisan. And that's certainly the case here with the Chamber of Commerce somehow endorsing Jason Lewis, Angie Craig, and Dean Phillips. Like I said, I would love to meet the voter who plans on voting for both Angie Craig and Jason Lewis in the same election. So let's move on to some other news. I want to talk about what's happening with the Supreme Court, because several Democratic senators last night made comments saying that they do not support court packing should Democrats win the White House and the Senate. Joe Biden has largely stayed away from this as well. And, well, there's a reason why they're doing this. They see this as being a potentially very unpopular move by the Democrats come 2021 if they rise to power. Because typically when you have a president who takes office, they have, if you think of it, like have a certain amount of political capital that they can spend. And that amount of capital's that amount of capital that they can spend goes down as time goes on, and typically by their first midterm election, they're very unpopular. That was true with Donald Trump. It was true with Barack Obama, true with George W. Bush, Bill Clinton. It's been true for just about every single president. And a lot of Democratic senators and even Joe Biden are thinking, well, do we really want to spend all of the potential political capital we could gain on stacking the Supreme Court? So, in terms of packing the Supreme Court, I have some mixed feelings about this. If they were to actually frame this in a different way where they could say we're trying to depoliticize the courts by going with maybe Pete Buttigieg's idea, where they would instead appoint five justices who would be appointed by a nonpartisan commission, or at least be appointed by the current justices. They would have to be approved unanimously, by the way. If they were to frame it that way, perhaps it would work, but I don't think they probably will because they want to stay away from that issue. But if it does mean they get rid of the filibuster and try to admit Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, perhaps it's worth it. But I think there could be another reason why Democrats don't want to pack the courts. And, well, it's not a very good reason. It has everything to do with political gains. And it's this right here. So for years, Republicans have always been the ones that have been able to claim that we're the victims when it comes to the Supreme Court, because we need justices who are going to overturn Roe versus Wade. Well, guess what? Now they're in that position where they can overturn Roe versus Wade. But prior to being able to have a conservative majority, that was always their argument, and it was a way that they could fire up their base to go and vote for the Supreme Court. Well, now things have kind of changed, where if Roe versus Wade is overturned, all of a sudden that voter enthusiasm for the Supreme Court probably moves in the direction of Democrats. So think of it this way. Yeah, the Democratic Party and leaders of the DNC probably wouldn't be happy to see a decision like Roe versus Wade overturned, but I think they could also use this as political capital. I'm not saying whether this is right or not. I think this is probably the thinking that people within the DNC are going with as a strategy, where if Roe versus Wade is overturned, they can use that as an issue to motivate their base and to go motivate their base to vote for Democratic candidates, especially in midterm elections. Republicans have been very successful doing this for years, and I wonder if Democrats could do the same thing should that decision, Roe versus Wade, get overturned by a new conservative Supreme Court. Like I said, I don't think that's necessarily a good moral justification, but when you look at political strategy, there are probably some leaders within the Democratic Party that could see that as an opportunity to gain some political capital by being able to tell their constituents, well, if you vote for us, we'll put in more justices that will reinstate Roe versus Wade. So that'll be an interesting battle to see happen in 2021 if you have Democrats take over, but also have a conservative Supreme Court. Because if Democrats do end up stacking the courts, well, then they kind of lose that argument and their motivation for their base. Again, not a good moral justification, but when you talk about political strategy, oftentimes morals go out the window. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break and come on back with some more news here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Anytime is the right time to update your music collection, so stop in at the Electric Fetus and browse their massive selection. You'll find everything from rock and pop to international and roots, and so much more, on CD and vinyl. Not only is Electric Fetus the best stop for music, but they also carry a wide and unique range of gifts. Bath products, clothing, books, stationery, candles, incense, you name it. That's the Electric Fetus at 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Hello, this is Ellie Krug from Ellie 2.0 Radio on Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m. Many listeners know that I train on human inclusivity and on how to be welcoming to diverse humans. Today, organizations of all sizes find that they need to train team members on equity and dismantling racism. I can do that. Many say that my trainings change how they see the world. And now I'm doing all of my work online so everyone can attend regardless of where you're located. For more information, go to elliekrug.com. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Hey, I guess we found a new name for our show.
Really? What's the new name?
Pilots Progressive Party.
How did you ever come up with that?
Pilots our name and Progressive Fun is our game.
Well, what's that about?
It's a one-hour news show with progressive guests and information you normally don't hear on the radio.
Well, that's so exciting. I have a few ideas for guests myself.
I know they'll be progressive.
Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on AM 950.
The Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
If you owe back taxes, there's a lot you need to know, starting with rule number one. Don't mess with the IRS. They are cracking down this year by sending out heart-stopping letters, actively garnishing paychecks, levying bank accounts, and putting liens on homes and businesses. That's all true. But it's also true there's a way out. It's called the Fresh Start Initiative, an important government program for tax debt assistance. It's one of the biggest breaks the IRS has ever offered, so now's the time. You could qualify for tax relief that saves you thousands, even tens of thousands. Nobody knows this program like the award-winning experts at Optima Tax Relief. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and will fight to get you the best deal possible. Don't mess with the IRS. For tax help you need, for tax help you can trust, call Optima now for a free consultation.
Call 800-704-9936. 800-704-9936. 800-704-9936.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
Auto Technical helps families in need of transportation with reconditioned vehicles. Here's Richard with Auto Technical.
I'll tell you, my wife told me when we first started, she says, you're going to find this so rewarding. But when people come in and, oh, man, give me a second.
Take your time.
And you just find out how important transportation is. People sometimes break down in tears and can't stop.
Learn more at autotechnical.org.
Back on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Thursday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So this comes to us out of the Hill as it's talking about a Wisconsin man who is suing the city of La Crosse and Governor Tony Evers after he was dismissed from a paid poll worker position for refusing to wear a mask at a voting precinct, citing a medical condition. And this is something I have come across a lot, where you have conservatives, at least I'm guessing they're conservatives or Trump supporters, saying, I can't wear a mask in this establishment because I have a medical condition, which absolutely bugs me because I'm disabled. I've been a member of the disabled community, have friends there too. And if you're someone who's faking having a disability just to not wear a mask, you're absolutely the worst human in the world. So this just bugs me every time I hear someone try to claim that they have a medical condition and therefore that's why I can't wear a mask. Absolutely hate it when people do that. Not sure if this guy in La Crosse really has a medical condition, but to be honest, if you're someone who is disabled and you legitimately can't wear a mask because of a medical condition, well, oftentimes the stores will do your shopping for you, and they'll be very much willing to assist you. But yeah, that just bugs me whenever I hear about that, people pretending they have a condition that does not allow them to wear a mask. Another story out of Wisconsin. This is Dateline from Kenosha, Wisconsin, and it comes to us from Time Magazine talking about QAnon. I, of course, talked about that a little bit yesterday. And this article in Time, and it's from Kenosha, talks about how conspiracy theories are shaping American politics, especially among the Republican rank and file. Just want to briefly read from this piece. So in Time, they interviewed a couple of people who are big-time QAnon supporters, and it just gives you a peek into their minds and the real cognitive dissonance that exists within their minds. So here we go. Frank says she spends most of her time researching child sex trafficking, while Arthur adds that she often finds this information on the Russian-owned search engine Yandex. Frank's eyes fill with tears as she describes what she's found. Children who are being raped and tortured so that the so-called Democratic cabal can extract their blood and drink it. She says Trump has seized the blood on the black market as part of his fight against the cabal. Quote, I think if Biden wins, the world is over, basically, adds Arthur. I would honestly try to leave the country. And if that wasn't an option, I would probably take my children and sit in the garage and turn my car on and it would all be over. How are you supposed to even talk to anyone like that? Someone that is so far gone that they believe that there is a child sex trafficking ring where politicians are drinking the blood of these children, and somehow superhero Donald Trump has been seizing this blood on the black market. All right, continuing with this piece in Time. This matters not just because of what these voters believe, but also because of what they don't. The facts that should anchor a sense of shared reality are meaningless to them. The news developments that might ordinarily inform their vote fall on deaf ears. They will not be swayed by data on the coronavirus deaths. They won't be persuaded by job losses or stock market gains. And they won't care if Trump called America's fallen soldiers losers or suckers, as The Atlantic reported, because they won't believe it. They are impervious to messaging, advertising, or data. They aren't infected with conspiracy. They appear to be inoculated against reality. Obviously, you're not going to convince anyone that's a QAnon supporter that what they believe is completely false. You can show them all the data that you want. You can show them news stories. You can show them facts and information. probably not going to sway their opinion one way or another. I don't know, Patrick, the only way I feel like you might be able to get through to someone who really believes in QAnon is just to go off the deep end with them. Invent your own wild, crazy conspiracy theory, convince them of said conspiracy theory, and then say, oh yeah, at the end of the day, that was false. I feel like on our end here, we could especially do that, being progressive radio hosts. We could probably say, well, you know, George Soros actually sends us our talking points every day, and we just read verbatim whatever George Soros wants us to say. I'm betting you and I could convince a whole lot of people that that's true, that George Soros and the DNC and Tom Perez, they're running their trafficking ring wherever we are, and we're getting their talking points, and we're reading them verbatim. I bet we could convince a whole bunch of people that that was true. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they already think that's true, so I don't really know if we'd have to do much to convince them that, in fact, that is true.
Yeah, probably a fair point, but if at the end of the day you were saying, oh yeah, I just made all that stuff up, I don't know if that would be an effective strategy, but either way, I just don't know how you even engage with someone who believes the sky is red when the sky is blue. That's the best analogy I can think of. When it comes to QAnon supporters, I only talk about this every once in a while because there are a lot of these candidates who are running for office this fall. As I brought up yesterday, there are 6 QAnon supporters running for the state legislature. And really, it ultimately falls on the Republican Party to disavow these people. Now, yesterday I brought up how Pat Garofalo, Republican representative, disavowed QAnon and said, anyone who supports that is not welcomed in the state legislature. I'm at least paraphrasing him. I just hope that they stick to their word should any of those supporters end up winning their election. Same thing at the federal level. Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia, QAnon supporter, very likely to win her congressional seat. Republicans have disavowed her, but should she get elected? I'm willing to bet she's still going to get all the usual committee assignments and will still be treated like a normal member of Congress.
Well, Tom Emmer yesterday on the flip side was basically like, well, we got to do what we got to do to win.
Yeah, win at all costs. As you said, there are other Republicans who say, screw it, if that means an extra seat for us, who cares what they believe? Who cares how crazy they are? All right, we got to take a break, but coming up next, we are going to be speaking with Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality. Stay with us.
Now, more than ever, we are being faced daily with the topic of human mortality, and for many people, a state...
And we're back for the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, Thursday edition of the show. Well, something I've talked about a few times in the past is the myth of shy Trump voters, as the theory goes that polls were off in 2016 because people were too shy or too embarrassed to tell pollsters that they were supporters of Donald Trump. Now, the whole thing is just silly on its face because, well, A, if you talk to anyone who's a Trump supporter, they're typically not very shy about their support for Donald Trump. But really what happened in 2016 is that we had a very unstable race where we had lots of undecideds who were wavering as to whether they were going to support Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And at the end of the race, they happened to break towards Donald Trump. And as a side note, 2020 has been a very stable race where we have not had many undecided voters. At least nowhere near the amount of undecided voters that we had in 2016. But now we actually have some data to back up the fact that shy Trump voters don't exist. It's a myth. And this comes from Morning Consult. So here's what they did. They selected a group of voters and surveyed half of them online and half of them by phone, with the thinking was that so-called shy Trump voters would be more likely to answer the survey truthfully online as opposed to speaking to a stranger over the phone. And when it came to certain embarrassing questions, such as inquiries about personal finances or attitudes about discrimination, guess what? The online respondents did answer differently than the phone respondents, but there was no meaningful difference between the two groups on questions of supporting Trump. So there you go. More evidence that this myth of the shy Trump voter is completely false.
And one more thing before I have to go. We have our debate watching party coming up this Tuesday at Crooner's Supper Club off of Moore Lake and Highway 65. These tickets are going very, very fast, and you need to order them ahead of time as soon as possible over at am950radio.com. We are not going to have any tickets available at the door, so you got to get those online ASAP. Now, I do want to point out, all summer long and for the past few months, Crooner's Supper Club has been conducting outdoor concerts in a very safe manner, where everyone is socially distanced, things are cleaned and sanitized, and mask wearing is required, and it's going to be the same deal for our debate watch party. So they're going to be taking extra measures to make sure everyone stays safe. So again, encourage you to get those tickets now. Not going to have any available at the door. It's our debate watch party coming up this Tuesday. Doors will open at 7:30 with the debate beginning at 8. It's at Crooner's Supper Club off Moore Lake and Highway 65, and you can only get those tickets at am950radio.com. That's am950radio.com. That's all the time I have. Matt McNeil is coming up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here on FYI Politics with Brent Johnson. Well, there's a series of community meetings taking place in Minneapolis that has to do with the recent murder of George Floyd. These are sponsored by Communities United Against Police Brutality, as they're holding what's called the People's Floyd Commission, which is a series of public meetings throughout the city of Minneapolis that will talk about the killing of George Floyd and the aftermath and where we go from here. So joining us to talk about that is Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality. Hey, Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about the People's Floyd Commission. It's a series of five events, although I should point out that two of them have already taken place. They all start at 6 p.m. around different areas of Minneapolis. So tell us about how these got started.
Sure. In the aftermath of major police uprisings in other places, you know, things like after the Rodney King beating or the Watts riots, things like that, there have been these commissions that have happened, generally generated by the government, to try to examine what caused the uprising, you know, what could be done to change the conditions so it doesn't happen again, et cetera. And so things like the Christopher Commission, you know, and that kind of stuff. And we have not seen anything like that in Minneapolis. Strangely, the city council declared, you know, back in early June, that we're going to have, defund or whatever the police, and it turned into, let's have a one-year conversation. And that conversation has never started. So we thought, this is just dumb. You know, why aren't we having a conversation among the community? It's like they don't want to hear what the community has to say. And so we decided that in the absence of the city taking action, that we needed to call forward people to give their testimony, you know, their, impressions and their experiences around what happened, not only in the conditions that led up to the killing of George Floyd, but in the response afterward. And so we set up these five hearings, and they're in parks all over the city so that it's, you know, safe, socially distanced and so forth. And we feed everybody, and we start each night. Each night focuses on a different topic, though people who testify can testify to anything they want to. But each night we sort of have a different topic. We set up a little bit of background on the topic for about 10 or 15 minutes at the beginning, and then we just shut up, and we have an open microphone, and people just walk on up and give testimony. We are capturing that testimony. We're working with On-Site Public Media, which is an organization that videotapes events and does, you know, kind of its own documentaries and things like that. And we're working with them, and they're capturing all of the video of these events. We're going to transcribe them and turn them into a report with additional recommendations of things that the city ought to be doing to ensure that we don't have any further George Floyd incidents.
Well, I like that idea that you are recording these and are eventually going to transcribe these, and I'm assuming you'll put those up perhaps on cuapb.org. That's your website for Communities United Against Police Brutality. Excellent. And boy, that's just unreal as well that the city, despite all that's happened the past few months, still has not set up any sort of meetings whatsoever. So glad you guys have taken that into your own hands, because you would think with the aftermath of what we saw, they would at least try to be doing something to put together these types of sessions.
Well, back at, I think it was about the end of July or thereabouts, they had a meeting. Prior to that, they had given their staff what they call a staff directive. They told them, come up with a way to do community engagement so we can start having this conversation. Well, the staff came back and reported, we haven't had time to figure it out yet, bosses. So then the city council gave them 2 more months to figure out how to have conversations with the community. It's like, it's not hard, people. Set up meetings, open up a microphone, and let people do it. And they somehow haven't been able to figure out how to have meetings where people can talk. A lot of it for the city is they like to have meetings that they get to control, so they can tell everybody, you get 3 minutes, you know, and all this kind of stuff. We aren't doing that at these hearings. People can talk for as long as they want to. You know, we ask people to be courteous for the others that are there that want to testify, but we basically just open up the microphones and let people share their experiences. And the things that people have talked about have been utterly amazing. Their experiences, you know, with police and the things that have happened to them at the hands of police right after George Floyd. You know, we had people talking about standing on their front porch and getting shot with paintballs by the police and, you know, by the National Guard and so forth. We've had a woman spoke passionately about what happens to deaf people in the community as a result of policing problems. You know, just all kinds of things where people talked about the conditions that led to George Floyd's killing as well as the aftermath. And it's just been astounding, frankly. So glad we're doing this event. And it gives people, you know, a wonderful opportunity to, you know, so the weather's still good yet. And we're having these events outside and people have the ability to then just be out there and give their words that are so important.
Again, these are a series of meetings that take place each Friday through October 9th, with the most recent meeting coming up this Friday at East Phillips Park, which is, I believe, as you say on the sheet here, I think it's, South 17th Avenue, just north of the park building. Either way, yeah, people can probably Google the East Phillips Park and figure out where that is. They begin each Friday at 6 p.m., and the topic on this Friday's meeting has to do with the city's response to George Floyd's killing. And there's certainly a lot to unpack there with this meeting coming up here, especially with reforms that were proposed by the city council. So I want to talk about that a little bit. What sort of response have you kind of gotten so far? What do you think about this idea that the city council put through earlier this summer in terms of changing the Minneapolis Police Department?
You know, the problem is they didn't have an actual concrete plan. What they really want is to take over the police from the mayor, and they don't have a concrete plan of how they're going to address policing in the city. And frankly, this whole time, they've never used the power they already did have. Our organization's position is that we need to downsize the police. We need to take the funds that result from that and reallocate those to more appropriate response for things that don't require law enforcement lens. We don't think we can actually, you know, eliminate the police, because you do need police for people to have access to the court system. So things like, you know, incidents of domestic abuse, rape, things like that, child abuse, we do want people to have access to the court system for their safety. But we do think they can be significantly downsized. The Minneapolis police have no business, you know, showing up at mental health crisis calls, drug overdoses, homeless encampments. You know, why are these police out there doing things that should be addressed through a social services or, you know, mental health professional lens? It doesn't make any sense. So we need to redirect the funds to a more appropriate response where we can. And then for the cops that are left, we need to rein them in. And the Minneapolis City Council has failed spectacularly in all of those areas. For example, they oversee the Office of Police Conduct Review, which is the complaint branch where you can go and complain about the police. In the 7.5 years that they've overseen this agency, the agency has taken in 3,133 complaints by members of the community. 13 have resulted in discipline. 13. That's a discipline rate of 0.42%, when the national average for civilian oversight bodies is 7 to 8%. So we are like the low-end outliers for the whole country. And yet the city council has, year in and year out, we've been telling them about these results. We get the data directly from the city, so we know they're accurate. Year in and year out, we tell them about it. And every year in and year out, they just keep passing the funding for it. They don't put any expectations on them for better results or anything. They just keep going along with the program. You know, there's 100 things the city could have been doing all along the way, and they've frankly failed in every opportunity. So at this point, you know, just giving them control over the police does not solve the problem. There are things that they could be doing right now. You know, they know now that their charter amendment is not going to make it on the ballot, obviously. And there are all these things they could be doing right now, and they're simply not doing them. And these are choices they make.
Well, what I like, too, is that you're really putting the focus on the city right now, because so often when we hear about the debate about the police, it often gets focused at the federal level or even at the state legislature. And I've said this many times on the show, where if you really want to have an impact on changing the way law enforcement works, it's all going to come at that city level. And as you pointed out, there are many things the city could be doing right now that they're not, in terms of trying to rein in the police. As you brought up, just that shocking stat, what was it, like 0.4% result in actual discipline, or was it even lower than that?
No, you have it right. You have it right. And it's pathetic. Yeah, 0.42%. And the thing is, you know, there are some things that the state needs to do, but most of what needs to happen locally. Our organization came out with a list of 44 areas that needed to be addressed at the state level. Well, it's a mix of state and local. And then we came out, because the city council seems so confused, we came out with a list of about 30 things that could be done right now by the city council without any action from the state. And we've put this in all the hands of all the council members. They've had it repeatedly sent to them. We've actually been trying to meet with them and talk with some of them. A few of them have met with us. Most of them are acting like COVID is a great excuse to avoid dealing with the community. And they've stuck their heads in the sand, and they don't want to hear about it because, you know, hey, we can't get a hold of controlling the police in total, so we're not willing to do anything. And, you know, this is a formula for disaster, and you're exactly right. Most of what needs to happen on the local level, because these police departments are hired and operated by the municipalities. So most police, you know, reforms or police changes need to happen at a local level. And yet our city council is sticking their head in the sand. You can't even get these people, you know, you send them emails, you call them, you write them letters, and they're just not responsive. They're just totally not responsive.
So I take it, as you've been holding these meetings with the People's Floyd Commission, as again we're speaking with Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality about the series of five meetings of the People's Floyd Commission. There are three more left, with the most recent one coming up this Friday at East Phillips Park at 6 p.m. I take it there's really been no involvement from the city whatsoever, no response in terms to any of your proposals or what's being discussed at these meetings. Is that kind of what I'm getting as a read right there? No official response from the city, or even just maybe a city councilor showing up and, you know, just showing up at one meeting and listening? Really nothing is what I'm gathering?
Nothing. I would say flat zero. And equally, not just the city council, the mayor. The mayor has been completely radio silent on this stuff. You know, we had a major incident happen in our city. I've been doing work on police accountability for going on 34 years now. I have never seen in the time I've been doing this work a group of people so angry that they burned down a police precinct. That just is unprecedented in this world. And it was so shocking to me that the city has just, you know, and what's happened here, stepped up protests all over the country, all over the world. And yet we have not, our mayor has barely spoken about this. You know, there's no, he's talking about, we need these work groups for transformation. Well, they formed three work groups that have all the same people on it that have been doing all of this non-stuff for years. The main people he put for the community work group, he put the Minneapolis Foundation in charge. What do they know about police accountability? They have no history or background doing this. There's not one person in the community that has history doing this work, that has any knowledge, that's on that work group. And more than that, not any people whose family members have been killed by police, not any people who themselves have suffered from police abuse on these work groups. So what results will we get? The same ones we've always gotten. And so, you know, you're right. It's a very sad statement. I honestly think, you know, and I said this right after George Floyd was killed, I honestly think that these politicians think they can put the genie back in the bottle. And I think they're about to find out that they can't.
So as I brought up, the next meeting is on September 25th. That's this Friday at East Phillips Park. You have two more coming up in October. One is October 2nd at Armitage Park, and then you have one on October 9th at Theodore Worth Park. So what are the focuses of the meetings going to be for October 2nd and October 9th? As you said, people can talk about kind of whatever they want at these, but generally you do come in kind of with a preset topic on where you mainly want to have things focused. So we dove in a little bit on what's happening this Friday, but what can people expect if they decide to attend the October 2nd or October 9th meetings?
Well, we're going to be talking a little bit on October 2nd about legal issues, you know, talking about how difficult it is for people who are harmed by police to get any kind of legal justice, but also to talk about people facing charges and people who are mounting civil lawsuits. The city is facing right now 5 civil lawsuits that I'm aware of, and I think there's going to be a lot more pretty soon, by people who lost their eye, like journalists who lost their eyes from being shot in the face with, you know, rubber bullets or tear gas canisters and things like that. There are, that I know of, 3 class action lawsuits. So we've asked the ACLU, who's running those 3 lawsuits, to speak on these panels. We've also asked individuals who are mounting their own lawsuits to talk about what they're going through and what's going to happen. You know, all of these lawsuits, people don't realize that the city of Minneapolis is self-insured. We don't have like an insurance policy for lawsuits. So all of this comes directly out of our budget. And so it's literally like we budget for police brutality. And I think that what's coming down the pike here is going to be very significant for the people who live here. For, you know, I live in Minneapolis, I own a home, you know, for the taxpayers here, we're going to see some real issues. And not that we don't want people to get justice. We absolutely want people to get justice. But we think that talking about how people have to resort to the legal system because they can't get any kind of justice otherwise is an important aspect. And then the October 9th will be the wrap-up of all of these 5 hearings. And then that night, we're going to talk about the state of police accountability today and going forward. In other words, what does the city need to do next? And so all of these are great opportunities for people to come, share their experiences, and, you know, take something away from the event as well. And we feed everybody. These are great events because people can be outside. The weather's decent. And, you know, and they're professionally run. We have a fabulous moderator, Toussaint Morrison, who is, you know, kind of fielding the discussion and making sure that people feel welcome to come to the microphone. And so we've had great testimony so far, and we're looking forward to more of the same on these next nights.
One of the final questions for you here, Michelle, has to do with this. I mean, how do we turn these discussions that we're having at these meetings into action? Because oftentimes when people see the word, we need to have conversations about police accountability, or we need to reimagine police accountability, and not saying you're doing this whatsoever, but oftentimes when people hear those phrases, they think, oh, well, that's just an excuse not to do anything. Like I said, you guys probably aren't doing that. You're probably actually trying to get action on what you're talking about. But how do we turn these discussions into actual action?
Well, you know what? You have to have concrete proposals, and that's exactly what we've done. But we always try to inform our concrete proposals, you know, our concrete ideas and specific actions with both what the community wants as well as what's evidence-based. So we do a lot of research in our organization for evidence-based best practices around policing. You know, in other words, we're not just running off going, oh, wouldn't it be nice if such and such happened? You know, we're actually thinking it through, we're researching it and things like that, but it also needs to be informed by what the community wants. And these are ways for us to find out what the community really wants to see happen. And when we do this and combine it with the research on evidence-based best practices, then you have actual concrete proposals. So the city council has no excuse because we're telling them, here's the things exactly that you need to do, this, this, and this, and this is how you do them. So right now, we, for example, have issued a white paper on ending police-only responses to mental health crisis calls. And what we're doing is we have a roadmap for them to follow. Here's how you can set up an alternative response or a co-response. Here's how you fund it. Here's how you, get it out in the community. Here's the logistics of how it's going to work. You know, we actually come up with the concrete for these folks because we don't expect them to be very imaginative. Let's just say they haven't shown much imagination in terms of how to actually get something done all along the way. So we're telling them how to get it done. And, hopefully they will take it up. If they don't, it's shameful and it's on them. And we will let it be known that we made it easy and they chose not to take it up. So, but we're not just going, oh, wouldn't it be nice, and this and that. We are actually telling them concretely what they need to do and exactly how to do it.
We've been speaking with Michelle Gross. She is with Communities United Against Police Brutality. Their website is CUAPB.org, CUAPB.org. As we're talking about the People's Floyd Commission, which is a series of five meetings taking place this fall, talking about the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. There are still three meetings left to attend, including this coming Friday at East Phillips Park in Minneapolis. Michelle, I'm assuming people can either follow you guys on social media or go to your website, CUAPB.org, to find more details about the People's Floyd Commission.
Yep, they certainly can. We have a great Facebook page with a big ad right on top. And we also have all of this same information on our website, as well as links to all of our reports of recommendations that I talked about earlier. People should really read this stuff because, these are well-reasoned actions that could be taken by the city council. And our job right now is to urge them to do it.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to check that out and hopefully have you back on the show to talk a little bit more about those ideas. Hey, Michelle, really appreciate the time today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And stick around. We'll come on back and have more on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.